The Horse Whisperer, Disc 8.
Chapter 24. Robert looked out through the rain-streaked window of the black cab at the woman on the billboard who'd been waving the same wave at him for the last 10 minutes. It was one of those electronically animated jobs where the arm actually moved. She was wearing Ray-Bans and a bright pink bathing suit, and in her other hand had what was probably meant to be a piña colada. She was doing her best to persuade Robert and several hundred other traffic-snarled, rain-soaked travelers that they'd be better off buying an air ticket to Florida. It was debatable, and a harder sell than it seemed, Robert knew, because the English newspapers had been going to town on stories about British tourists in Florida being mugged, raped, and shot. As the cab crawled forward, Robert could see some wag had scrawled by the woman's feet, "Don't forget your Uzi." He realized too late that he should have taken the underground. Every time he'd been to London, in the last 10 years, they'd been digging up some new section of the road out to the airport, and he was pretty sure they didn't just save it up for when he came. The flight to Geneva was due to leave in 35 minutes, and at this rate he'd miss it by about 2 years. The cab driver had already informed him, with something suspiciously approaching relish, that out at the airport there was a right pea super. There was. And he didn't miss his flight. It was cancelled. He sat in the business class lounge and for a couple of hours enjoyed the camaraderie of a growing band of harassed executives, each pursuing his or her own self-important path to a coronary. He tried calling Annie but got the answering machine, and he wondered where they were. He'd forgotten to ask their plans for this first Memorial Day in years they hadn't spent together. He left a message and sang a few bars of the Halls of Montezuma for Grace, something he did over breakfast on this day as a cue for groans and missiles. Then he took a final look at the notes of today's meeting, which had gone well, and the paperwork for tomorrow's, which might also, if he ever got there. And then he put it all away and went for another walk around the departure area. As he was looking idly and for no good reason at a rack of cashmere golf sweaters that he wouldn't have wished upon his worst enemy, someone said hello, and he looked up and saw a man who came as close to that category as anyone he knew. Freddie Kane was something medium to small in publishing, one of those people you never question too closely about the exact nature of their business for fear of embarrassing not them but yourself. He compensated for whatever deficiencies might lie in that murky area by making it clear that he had a personal fortune and furthermore knew every piece of gossip there was to know about anyone who was anyone in New York. By forgetting Robert's name on each of the 4 or 5 occasions they'd been introduced, Freddie had made it equally clear that he didn't count Annie Graves's husband among this number. Annie, on the other hand, he very much did.
"Hi! I thought it was you. How you doing?"
He thumped one hand on Robert's shoulder and used the other to pump his hand in a way that somehow managed to be simultaneously both violent and flaccid. Robert smiled and noted that the man had on a pair of those glasses movie stars were all now wearing in the hope that it made them look more intellectual. He'd clearly forgotten Robert's name again. They chatted for a while over the golf sweaters, swapping information on destinations, estimated arrivals, and the properties of fog. Robert was oblique and guarded about why he was in Europe, not because it was secret, but because he could see how frustrated it made Freddie. And it was perhaps revenge for this that motivated the man's closing remarks.
"I hear Annie's got herself a Gates problem," he said.
"I'm sorry?" Freddie put a hand to his mouth and made a face like a guilty schoolboy. "Oops, maybe we're not supposed to know." "I'm sorry, Freddie, you're way ahead of me."
"No, it's just a little bird told me Crawford Gates is out headhunting again. Probably not a word of truth in it."
"How do you mean headhunting?"
"Oh, you know how it's always been at that place, musical chairs and shoot the pianist. I just heard he was giving Annie a hard time, that's all."
"Well, it's the first I've..."
"Just gossip, shouldn't have mentioned it."
He gave a satisfied grin, and having fulfilled what may indeed have been the sole purpose of the encounter, said he'd better get back to the airline desk to do some more complaining. Back in the business lounge, Robert helped himself to another beer and flipped through a copy of The Economist, mulling over what Freddie had said.
Although he'd played ingenuous, he'd known right away what the man was getting at. It was the second time in a week that he'd heard it. The previous Tuesday, he'd been at a reception given by one of his firm's big clients. It was the kind of do he normally made excuses to avoid, but which, with Annie and Grace away, he'd actually found himself looking forward to. It was held in several sumptuous acres of office near Rockefeller Center, with mountains of caviar high enough to ski on. Whatever the latest collective noun for a gathering of lawyers was, they came up with a new and more disparaging one each week, there was certainly one of them here. There were many faces from other law firms that Robert recognized, and he guessed the host's motive for inviting them all was to keep his own firm on their toes. Among the other lawyers was Don Farlow. They'd only met once before, but Robert liked him and knew Annie did too, and that she rated him highly. Farlow greeted him warmly, and Robert was pleased to find as they chatted that they shared not just an appetite bordering on greed for caviar, but a wholesomely cynical attitude about those who'd provided it. They staked a claim beside the nursery slopes, and Farlow listened sympathetically while Robert told him how the litigation over Grace's accident was progressing, or rather not progressing, for it was getting so complicated it seemed destined to drag on for years. Then the talk moved on. Farlow asked after Annie and how things were going out west. "Annie's sensational," said Farlow. "The very best. The crazy thing is that asshole Gates knows that." Robert asked him what he meant, and Farlow looked surprised and then embarrassed. He quickly changed the subject, and the only other thing he said as he went was that Robert should tell Annie to come back soon. Robert had gone straight home and called Annie. She'd made light of it. "That place is Paranoia Palace," she said. Oh, sure, Gates had been giving her a hard time, but no more than usual. "The old bastard knows he needs me more than I need him." Robert had let it drop, even though he felt that her bravado seemed intended more to convince herself than him. Now, if Freddie Kane knew about it, it was a safe bet that most of New York knew too, or soon would. And though this wasn't Robert's world, he'd seen enough of it to know which was more important, what was said or what was true. Chapter 25. Hank and Darlene normally held their barn dance on the 4th of July. But this year Hank was scheduled to have his varicose veins fixed at the end of June and didn't fancy hobbling around, so they'd hauled it back a month or so to Memorial Day. There was risk involved. A few years back, 2 feet of snow had fallen this very weekend, and some Hank had invited felt a day set aside to honor those who'd died for their country wasn't a suitable day for a celebration at all. Hank said, shit, come to that, celebrating independence was pretty dumb, too, when you'd been married as long as him and Darlene, and anyway, all those he knew who'd gone to Vietnam liked a damn good party, so what the hell? Just to show him, it rained. Rivers of it slid off billowing tarpaulins to hiss among the burgers, ribs, and steaks on the barbecue, and a fuse box exploded with a flash and snuffed all the colored lights strung around the yard. No one seemed to mind too much. They all just packed into the barn. Someone gave Hank a T-shirt, which he immediately put on. It had "I Told You" printed on the front in big black letters. Tom was late arriving because the vet couldn't get out to the Double Divide till after 6. He'd given the little filly another shot and thought that would do it. They were still busy with her when the others left for the party. Through the open doors of the barn, he'd seen all the kids piling into the lariat with Annie and Grace. Annie had waved to him and asked if he was coming. He told her he'd be along later. He was pleased to see she was wearing the dress she'd worn 2 nights before. Neither she nor Grace had spoken a word about what had happened that night. On Sunday, he'd risen before dawn and dressed in the dark and seen Annie's blinds still open and the lights still on. He'd wanted to go on up and see if everything was okay, but thought he'd leave it a while in case it seemed nosy. When he'd finished seeing to the horses and came in for breakfast, Diane said Annie had just called to ask if it would be all right if she and Grace came with them to church. "Probably just wants to write it up in her magazine," Diane said. Tom told her he thought that was unfair and that she should give Annie a break. Diane hadn't spoken to him for the rest of the day. They'd all driven to church in 2 cars, and it was clear at once, to Tom at least,
that something had changed between Annie and Grace. There was a stillness there. He noticed how when Annie spoke, Grace now looked her in the eyes, and how after they'd parked the cars, the two of them linked arms and walked together all the way to the church. There wasn't room for them all in one row, so Annie and Grace had sat a row in front, where a shaft of sun angled down from a window, trapping slow convections of dust. Tom could see the other church folk looking at the newcomers, the women as much as the men. And he found his own eyes kept returning to the nape of Annie's neck when she stood to sing or tilted her head in prayer. Back at the Double Divide, later, Grace had ridden Gonzo again, only this time in the big arena with everyone watching. She walked him a while, then, when Tom told her to, took him up to a trot. She was a little tight at the start, but once she relaxed and found the feel, Tom could see how sweetly she rode. He told her a couple of things about the way she was using her leg, and when it all clicked, he said to go ahead and move on up to a lope. A lope? Why not? So she did, and it was fine, and as she opened her hips and moved with the motion, he saw the grin break out on her face. "Shouldn't she be wearing a hat?" Annie had asked him quietly. She meant one of those safety helmets people wore in England and back east, and he'd said, "Well, no, not unless she was planning on falling off." He knew he should have taken it more seriously, but Annie seemed to trust him and left it at that. Grace slowed in perfect balance and brought Gonzo to an easy stop before them, and everyone clapped and cheered. The little horse looked like he'd won the Kentucky Derby, and Grace's smile was wide and clear as a morning sky. After the vet had left, Tom showered, put on a clean shirt, and set off through the rain for Hank's place. It was coming down so thick the old Chevy's wipers all but gave in, and Tom had to peer with his nose to the glass to negotiate a way through the flooded craters of the old gravel road. There were so many cars when he got there that he had to park right out on the driveway, and if he hadn't worn his slicker, he'd have been soaked by the time he got to the barn. As soon as he walked in, Hank saw him and came over with a beer. Tom laughed at the T-shirt, and even as he took off his slicker, realized he was already scanning the faces for Annie. The barn was large, but still too small for all the folk packed into it. There was country music playing, almost drowned by the sound of talk and laughter. People were still eating. Every now and then, the wind would drive a cloud of smoke from the barbecue in through the open doors. Mostly people ate standing up because the tables hauled in from outside were still wet. While he chatted with Hank and a couple of other guys, Tom let his eyes travel the room. One of the empty stalls on the far side had been turned into a bar, and he could see Frank helping out behind it. Some of the older kids, including Grace and Joe, were gathered around the sound system, going through the box of tapes and groaning at the embarrassing prospect of their parents trying to dance to the Eagles and Fleetwood Mac. Nearby, Diane was telling the twins for the last time to quit throwing food or she'd take them right home. There were many faces Tom knew, and many who greeted him, but there was only one he was looking for, and at last he saw her. She stood in the far corner with an empty glass in her hand, talking with Smokey, who'd come up from New Mexico, where he'd been working since Tom's last clinic. It was Smoke who seemed to be doing most of the talking. Every so often, Annie glanced around the room, and Tom wondered if she was looking for anyone in particular, and if so, whether it might be him. Then he told himself not to be such a damn fool and went and got himself some food. Smokey knew who Annie was as soon as they were introduced. "You're the one done calling when we were doing the Marin County Clinic," he said. Annie smiled. "That's right. Hell, I remember him calling me when he came back from New York saying there was no way he was going to work with that horse. Now here y'all are." "He changed his mind." "Ma'am, he sure must have. Ain't never seen Tom do something he didn't want." Annie asked him questions about his work with Tom and what went on at the clinics, and it was clear from the way he spoke that Smokey worshipped the ground Tom walked. He said there were quite a few people now doing clinics and things, but not one of them was in the same league or even close. He told her about things he'd seen Tom do, horses he'd helped that most folk would have taken out and shot. "When he lays his hands on them, you can see all the trouble just kind of fall out of them."
Annie said he hadn't done this yet with Pilgrim, and Smokey said that must be because the horse wasn't yet ready. "It sounds like magic," she said. "No, ma'am, it's more than magic. Magic's just tricks." Whatever it was, Annie had felt it. She'd felt it when she watched Tom work, when she rode with him. In truth, she felt it almost every moment she was with him. It was this that she had contemplated yesterday morning when she woke with Grace still sleeping beside her and saw the dawn spilling in through the faded drapes that now hung unmoving. For a long time she'd lain quite still, cradled in the calm of her daughter's breathing. Once, from a distant dream, Grace murmured something that Annie labored in vain to decipher. It was then she'd noticed among the pile of books and magazines beside the bed the copy of Pilgrim's Progress Liz Hammond's cousins had given her. She hadn't opened it, nor had she any idea that Grace had brought it in here. Annie slipped quietly from the bed and took it to the chair by the window where there was just enough light to read. She remembered listening wide-eyed to the story as a child, captivated on a simple, literal level by the story of little Christian's heroic journey to the Celestial City. Reading it now, the allegory seemed obvious and clumsy, but there was a passage near the end that made her pause. "Now I saw in my dream that by this time the pilgrims were got over the enchanted ground, and entering into the country of Beulah, whose air was very sweet and pleasant. The way lying directly through it, they solaced themselves there for a season. Yea, here they heard continually the singing of birds, and saw every day the flowers appear in the earth, and heard the voice of the turtle in the land. In this country the sun shineth night and day. Wherefore this was beyond the valley of the shadow of death, and also out of the reach of giant despair. Neither could they from this place so much as see Doubting Castle. Here they were within sight of the city they were going to, also here met some of the inhabitants thereof. For in this land the Shining Ones commonly walked, because it was upon the borders of heaven." Annie read the passage three times and read no farther. It was this that had led her to call Diane to ask if she and Grace could come to church. However, the urge, so wildly out of character that it made even Annie laugh, had little, if anything, to do with religion. It had to do with Tom Booker. Annie knew that somehow he had set the scene for what had happened. He had unlocked a door through which she and Grace had found each other. "Don't let her turn you away," he'd told her. And she hadn't. Now she simply wanted to give thanks, but in a ritualized way that wouldn't embarrass anyone. Grace had teased her when she told her, asking how many centuries it was since she'd last seen the inside of a church. But she said it with affection and was plainly happy to come along. Annie's head refocused on the party. Smokey didn't seem to have noticed her drifting. He was in the middle of some long, involved story about the man who owned the ranch he was working at down in New Mexico. While Annie listened, she went back to doing what she'd spent most of the evening doing, looking out for Tom. Maybe he wasn't coming after all. Hank and the other men cleared the tables out into the rain again, and the dancing began. The music was louder now, and still country, so that, led by the most streetwise among them, the kids could keep up their groaning, no doubt secretly relieved at not having to dance themselves. Laughing at your parents was a whole lot more fun than having them laugh at you. One or two of the older girls had broken ranks and were dancing, and the sight suddenly had Annie worried. Stupidly, until now, it hadn't occurred to her that seeing others dance might upset Grace. She made an excuse to Smokey and went to find her. Grace was sitting by the stalls with Joe. They saw Annie coming, and Grace whispered something to him that made him grin. It was gone from his face by the time Annie got there. He stood up to greet her. "Ma'am, would you like to dance?" Grace burst out laughing, and Annie gave her a suspicious glance. This is entirely unprompted, of course, she said. Of course, ma'am. And not by any remote chance, a dare. Mom, that's so rude, Grace said. What a terrible thing to suggest. Joe kept a perfect straight face. No, ma'am, absolutely not. Annie looked again at Grace, who now read her mind. Mom, if you think I'm going to dance with him to this music, forget it. Then thank you, Joe, I'd be delighted. So they danced. And Joe danced well, and even though the other kids hooted, he didn't turn a hair. It was while they were dancing that she saw Tom. He was watching her from the bar and waved, and the sight of him gave her such a teenage thrill that at once she felt embarrassed because maybe it showed. When the music stopped, Joe gave a courteous bow and escorted her back to Grace, who hadn't stopped laughing. Annie felt a touch on her shoulder and turned. It was Hank. He wanted the next dance and wouldn't take no for an answer. By the time they'd finished, he had Annie laughing so much her sides ached. But there was no respite. Frank was next, then Smokey. As she danced, she looked over and saw Grace and Joe were now doing a jokey kind of dance with the twins and some other kids. Jokey enough, anyway, to allow Grace and Joe the illusion that they weren't really dancing with each other. She watched Tom dance with Darlene, then Diane, then more closely with some pretty younger woman Annie didn't know and didn't much want to know. Perhaps it was some girlfriend she hadn't heard about. And every time the music stopped, Annie looked for him and wondered why he didn't come and ask her to dance. He saw her making her way across to the bar after she danced with Smokey, and as soon as he could do so politely, he thanked his partner and followed. It was the third time he tried to reach her, but someone always got there first. He weaved his way behind her through the hot crowd and saw her wipe the sweat from her brow with both hands back through her hair, just as she'd done when he met her out running. There was a dark patch on her back where the fabric of her dress had grown wet and clung to her skin. As he got near, he could smell her perfume mixed with another, more subtle and potent, that was all her own. Frank was back serving behind the bar, and he saw Annie and asked her over other people's heads what she wanted. She asked him for a glass of water. Frank said sorry there wasn't any, only Dr. Pepper's. He handed her one, and she thanked him and turned, and Tom was standing right there in front of her. Hi, she said. Hi. So Annie Graves likes to dance. As a matter of fact, I can't stand it. It's just that here no one gives you the choice. He laughed and decided, therefore, that he wouldn't ask her, though he'd looked forward to it all evening. Someone pushed between them, cutting them off from each other for a moment. The music had started up again, so they had to shout to make each other hear. You obviously do, she said. What? Like to dance? I saw you. I guess, but I saw you too, and I reckon you like it more than you say. Oh, you know, sometimes when I'm in the mood. You want some water? I would die for water. Tom called to Frank for a clean glass and handed back the Dr. Peppers. Then he put a hand lightly on Annie's back to steer her through the crowd and felt the warmth of her body through the damp dress. Come on. He found a path for them among all the people, and all she could think of was the feel of his hand on her back, just below her shoulder blades and the clasp of her bra. As they skirted the dance floor, she chided herself for telling him she didn't like to dance, for otherwise he'd surely have asked her, and there was nothing she wanted more. The great barn doors stood open, and the disco lights lit the rain outside like a bead curtain of ever-changing color. There was no longer any wind, but the rain fell so hard it made a breeze of its own, and others had gathered in the doorway for the cool Annie now felt on her face. They stopped and stood together on the brink of shelter, and peered out through the rain whose roar made distant the music behind them. No longer was there reason for his hand to be on her back, and though she hoped he wouldn't, he took it away. Across the yard, she could just make out the lights of the house, like a lost ship, where she assumed they were headed for her drink of water. We'll get drenched, she said. I'm not that desperate.
I thought you said you'd die for water.
Yes, but not in it. Though they say drowning's the best way to go. I always thought, how on earth did they know that?
He laughed. You sure do a lot of thinking, don't you?
Yep, always fizzing away up there, can't stop it.
Kind of gets in the way sometimes, don't it?
Yeah.
Like now. He saw she didn't understand. He pointed toward the house. Here we are, looking out through the rain, and you're thinking, too bad, no water.
Annie gave him a wry look and took the glass from his hand. Kind of a forest and trees situation, you mean?
He shrugged and smiled, and she reached out into the night with the glass. The pricking of the rain on her bare arm was startling, almost painful. The roar of its falling excluded all but the two of them. And while the glass filled, they held each other's eyes in a communion of which humor was only the surface. It took less time than it seemed, or than either seemed to want. Annie offered it first to him, but he just shook his head and kept watching her. She watched him back over the rim of the glass as she drank. And the water tasted cool and pure, and so purely of nothing that it made her want to cry.
Chapter 26. Grace could tell something was going on as soon as she climbed into the Chevy beside him. The smile gave it away, like a kid who'd hidden the candy jar. She swung the door shut, and Tom pulled away from the back of the Creek House and headed down toward the corrals. She'd only just got back from her morning session with Terry and Shoto and was still eating a sandwich.
What is it? She said.
What's what?
She narrowed her eyes at him, but he was all innocence.
Well, for a start, you're early.
I am. He shook his wristwatch. Darn thing.
She saw it was a lost cause and sat back to finish her sandwich. Tom gave her that funny smile again and kept driving. The second clue was the rope he picked up from the barn before they went down to Pilgrim's Corral. It was much shorter than the one he used as a lasso and of a narrower gauge, plied in an intricate crisscross of purple and green.
What's that?
It's a rope. Pretty, isn't it?
I meant, what is it for?
Well, Grace, there's no end to things a hand could do with a rope like this.
Like swing from trees, tie yourself up.
Yep, that kind of thing.
When they got to the corral, Grace leaned on the rail where she usually did, and Tom went in with the rope. Away in the far corner, as usual too, pilgrims started snorting and trotting to and fro as if marking out some futile last resort. His tail, ears, and the muscles on his sides seemed wired to a convulsive current. He watched Tom every step of the way. But Tom didn't look at him. As he walked, he was doing something with the rope, though what, because his back was to her, Grace couldn't tell. Whatever it was, he went on with it after he stopped in the center of the corral, and still he didn't look up. Grace could see Pilgrim was as intrigued as she was. He'd stopped his pacing and now stood watching. And though every so often he tossed his head and pawed the ground, his ears reached out at Tom as if pulled by elastic. Grace moved slowly along the rails to get a better angle on what Tom was doing. She didn't have to go far because Tom turned toward her so that his shoulder masked what he was doing from Pilgrim. But all Grace could see was that he seemed to be tying the rope into a series of knots. Briefly, he looked up and smiled at her from under the brim of his hat.
Kind of curious, ain't he?
Grace looked at Pilgrim. He was more than curious. And now that he couldn't see what Tom was doing, he did what Grace had done and took a few small steps to get a better look. Tom heard him and at the same time moved a couple of steps farther away, turning too so that he now had his back to the horse. Pilgrim stood a while and looked off to one side, taking stock. Then he looked at Tom again and took a few more tentative steps toward him. And Tom heard him again and moved off so the space between them stayed almost, but not quite, the same. Grace could see he'd finished tying the knots, but he went on pulling them and working at them. And suddenly she saw what it was he'd made. It was a simple halter.
She couldn't believe it. "Are you going to try and get that on him?" Tom gave her a grin and said in a stage whisper, "Only if he begs me." Grace was too involved to know how long it took. 10, maybe 15 minutes, but not a lot more. Every time Pilgrim came nearer, Tom would move off, denying him the secret and fueling his desire to know it. And then Tom would stop, and with every stop reduce by a fraction the gap between them. By the time they'd twice circled the corral and Tom had worked his way back to the center, they were only some dozen paces apart. Now Tom turned so that he stood at right angles, still calmly working away at the rope, and though once he looked up at Grace and smiled, never did he look at the horse. Thus ignored, Pilgrim blew and looked to one side, then the other. Then he took two or three more steps toward Tom. Grace could see he expected the man to move off again, but this time he didn't. The change surprised him, and he stopped and looked around again to see if anything else in the world, including Grace, could help him make sense of this. Finding no answer, he stepped closer, then closer still, blowing and craning his nose to get a whiff of whatever danger this man might have up his sleeve, and balancing the risk against a now overwhelming need to know what he had in his hands. At last he was so close that his whiskers almost brushed the brim of Tom's hat, and Tom must have felt the snuffling breath on the back of his neck. Now Tom moved away a couple of steps, and though the movement wasn't sudden, Pilgrim jumped like a startled cat and nickered. But he didn't go away. And when he saw Tom was now facing him, he calmed. Now he could see the rope. Tom was holding it in both hands for him to have a good look. But looking wasn't enough. As Grace knew, he'd have to get a smell of it, too. For the first time, Tom was now looking at him, and he was saying something, too, though what, Grace was too far off to hear. She bit her lip as she watched, willing the horse forward. "Go on, he won't hurt you, go on." But he needed no urging other than his own curiosity. Hesitantly, but with a confidence that grew with every step, Pilgrim walked to Tom and put his nose to the rope. And once he'd sniffed the rope, he started sniffing Tom's hands. And Tom just stood there and let him. In that moment, in that quivering touch between horse and man, Grace felt many things connect. She couldn't have explained it, even to herself. She simply knew that some seal had been set on all that had happened in the days just past. Finding her mother again, riding, the confidence she'd felt at the party, all this Grace hadn't quite dared trust, as though at any second someone might snatch it all away. There was such hope, however, such a promise of light in this tentative act of trust by Pilgrim, that she felt something shift and open within her, and knew that it was permanent. With what was plainly consent, Tom now slowly moved one hand to the horse's neck. There was a quiver, and for a moment Pilgrim seemed to freeze, but it was only caution. And when he felt the hand upon him and realized it brought no pain, he eased and let Tom rub him. It went on a long time. Slowly Tom worked his way up until he'd covered the whole of his neck, and Pilgrim let him. And then he let him do the same on the other side, and even feel his mane. It was so matted it stood like spikes between Tom's fingers. Then, gently and still without hurry, Tom slipped the halter on, and Pilgrim did not balk, nor even for a moment demur. The only thing that bothered him about showing this to Grace was that she might make too much of it. It was always fragile when a horse took this step, and with this horse it was more than fragile. Not the eggshell, but the membrane within it. He could read in Pilgrim's eyes and in the quiver of his flanks how close he was to rejecting it. And if he rejected it, the next time, if there was one, would be worse. For many days Tom had worked for this, in the mornings, without Grace knowing. He did different things when she was watching in the afternoons, mainly flagging and driving and getting the horse used to the feel of a thrown rope. But working toward the halter was something he wanted to do alone. And until this very morning, he hadn't known whether it would ever happen, whether the spark of hope he'd told Annie about was truly there. Then he'd seen it and stopped, because he wanted Grace to be there when he blew on it and made it glow. He didn't have to look at her to know how much it moved her. What she didn't know, and maybe he should have told her before instead of being such a smartass, was that it wasn't all now going to be sweetness and light. There was work to come that might make Pilgrim seem cloaked yet again in madness. But that could wait. Tom wasn't going to start now. This moment belonged to Grace, and he didn't want to spoil it. So he told her to come in, as he knew she must long to. He watched her prop her cane against the gatepost and come carefully with only the slightest sign of a limp across the corral. When she was nearly up to them, Tom told her to stop. It was better to let the horse come to her than her to him, and with barely a nudge on the halter rope, he did so. He could see Grace biting her lip, trying not to tremble as she held her hands out below the horse's nose. There was fear on both sides, and it was surely a greeting of a lesser kind than Grace must remember. But in the sniffing of her hands, then later of her face and hair, Tom thought he saw at least a glimpse of what they once had been together, and yet might be again. Annie, this is Lucy. Are you there? Annie let the question hang for a while. She was composing an important memo to all her key people on how they should handle interference from Crawford Gates. The basic message was tell him to go fuck himself. She'd switched the answering machine on to give herself peace so that she could find an only slightly more veiled way of saying it. Shit. You're probably out chopping off cow's balls or whatever the hell it is they do out there. Listen, Well, just call me, will you? There was a troubled note in her voice that made Annie pick up. Cows don't have balls. Speak for yourself, kiddo. So we were lurking there, were we? Screening, Luce. It's called screening. What's up? He fired me. What? The son of a bitch fired me. Annie had seen it coming for weeks. Lucy was the first person she'd hired, her closest ally. By firing her, Gates was sending the clearest possible signal. Annie listened with a dull sinking in her chest while Lucy told her how it happened. The pretext had been a piece on women truck drivers. Annie had seen the copy, and though predictably preoccupied with sex, it was a lot of fun. The pictures were terrific, too. Lucy had wanted a big headline that said simply, Mother Truckers. Gates had vetoed it, saying Lucy was obsessed with sleaze. They'd had a stand-up fight in front of the whole office, during the course of which Lucy had told Gates bluntly to do what Annie was trying to find a euphemism for in her memo. I'm not going to let him do this, Annie said. Kiddo, it's done. I'm gone. No, you're not. He can't do it. He can, Annie. You know he can, and shit, I'd had enough anyway. It's no fun anymore. There were a few seconds of silence while they both thought about that. Annie sighed. Annie? What? You better get back here, you know? And quick. Grace came home late, bubbling with all that had happened with Pilgrim. She helped Annie serve supper and told her while they ate how it had felt to touch him again, how he'd trembled. He hadn't let her stroke him as he'd let Tom, and she'd felt a little upset at how briefly he tolerated her near him. But Tom said it would come, you just had to take it a step at a time. Pilgrim wouldn't look at me. It was weird, like he was ashamed or something. Of what happened? No, I don't know, maybe just of the way he is. She told Annie how later Tom had led him up to the barn and they'd washed him down. He'd allowed Tom to pick up his feet and clean some of the compacted filth out of them, and though he wouldn't let his mane or tail be cleaned, they'd at least managed to get a brush to most of his coat. Grace suddenly stopped and gave Annie a look of concern. You okay? I'm fine. Why? I don't know. You looked sort of worried or something. Just tired, I guess, that's all. When they were almost through eating, Robert called, and Grace went and sat at Annie's desk and told the same story all over again while Annie cleared the dishes. She stood at the sink, washing pans and listening to the frenzied clatter of a bug trapped among corpses he maybe recognized in one of the fluorescent lights. Lucy's call had cast a reflective shadow that even Grace's news had failed fully to dispel. Her spirits had lifted briefly when she heard the scrunch of the Chevy's wheels outside, bringing Grace back from the corrals. She and Tom hadn't spoken since the barn dance, though he'd scarcely been out of her thoughts, and she'd quickly checked her reflection in the glass door of the oven, thinking, hoping that he'd come in. But he'd just waved and driven off. Lucy's call had hauled her back, as in a different way Robert's did now, into what she knew with dulling acknowledgement to be her real life. Though what she meant by real, Annie no longer knew. Nothing, in a sense, could be more real than the life they'd found here. So what was the difference between these two lives? One, it seemed to Annie, was comprised of obligations and the other of possibilities. Hence, perhaps, the notion of reality. For obligations were palpable, soundly rooted in reciprocal deeds. Possibilities, on the other hand, were chimeras, flimsy and worthless, dangerous even. And as you grew older and wiser, you realized this and closed them off. It was better that way. Of course it was. The bug in the light was trying a new tactic, taking long rests, then hurling himself at the plastic casing with doubled effort. Grace was telling Robert how the day after tomorrow she was going to help drive the cattle up to the summer pastures, and how they'd all be sleeping rough. Yes, she said, of course she'd be riding. How else was she supposed to go? Dad, you don't have to worry, okay? Gonzo's fine. Annie finished in the kitchen and switched off the lights to give the bug a break. She walked slowly into the living room and stopped to stand behind Grace's chair, idly arranging the girl's hair on the back of her shoulders. "She's not coming," Grace said. "She says she's got too much work to do." "She's right here. Do you want to talk to her?" "Okay. I love you too, Danny." She vacated the chair for Annie and went off upstairs to run a bath. Robert was still in Geneva. He said he would probably be flying back to New York the following Monday. He'd told Annie 2 nights ago what Freddie Kane had said, and now, wearily, she told him about Gates firing Lucy. Robert listened in silence and then asked her what she was going to do about it. Annie sighed. "I don't know. What do you think I should do?" There was a pause, and Annie sensed he was thinking carefully about what he was about to say. "Well, from out there, I don't think there's a whole lot you can do."
"You're saying we should come back?"
"No, I'm not saying that."
"With everything going so well with Grace and Pilgrim?"
"No, Annie, I didn't say that."
"That's what it sounded like."
She could hear him inhale deeply, and suddenly she felt guilty about twisting his words when she wasn't being honest about her own motives for staying. His voice, when he resumed, was measured.
"I'm sorry if that's how it sounded.
It's wonderful about Grace and Pilgrim. It's important you all stay out there as long as you need to."
"More important than my job, you mean?"
"Christ, Annie!"
"I'm sorry."
They talked about other, less contentious things, and by the time they said goodbye, they were friends again, though he didn't tell her he loved her. Annie hung up and sat there. She hadn't meant to attack him like that. It was more that she was punishing herself for her own inability or reluctance to sort out the tangle of half-realized desires and denials that churned within her. Grace had the radio on in the bathroom. An oldies station was doing what they kept calling a Major Monkeys retrospective. They'd just played Daydream Believer, and now it was Last Train to Clarksville. Grace must have fallen asleep or have her ears underwater. Suddenly, and with suicidal clarity, Annie knew what she was going to do. She would tell Gates that if he didn't reinstate Lucy Friedman, she would resign. She would fax him the ultimatum tomorrow. If it was still okay with the bookers, she would, after all, go on the damned cattle drive. And when she came back, she would either have a job or she wouldn't. Chapter 6. Chapter 27. The herd curled up toward him around the shoulder of the ridge like a spilling black river in reverse. Here the contours of the land gave all the marshalling required, forcing the cattle upward on a curving trail which, though neither fenced nor marked, was yet their only option. Tom always liked to ride ahead here and stop high on the slope to watch them come. The other riders were coming now, set strategically above and about the edge of the herd, Joe and Grace to the right, Frank and the twins on the left, and appearing now at the rear, Diane and Annie. Beyond them, the plateau they had just crossed was a sea of wildflowers through which their passage had churned a wake of green, and at whose distant shore they'd rested under a noon sun and watched the cattle drink. From where Tom now stood his horse, you could see but the faintest shimmer of the pool, and nothing at all of the valley beyond, where the land fell away to the meadows and cottonwood creeks of the Double Divide. It was as if the plateau shelved seamless and straight to the vast plains and the eastern rim of the sky. The calves looked dapper and strong, with a fine luster to their coats. Tom smiled to himself when he thought of the sorry beasts they'd driven that spring some 30 years ago when his father first brought them to live out here. Some had been so scrawny you could almost hear the rattle of their ribs. Daniel Booker had ranched some serious winters back at Clark's Fork, but nothing as harsh as he found on the front. In that first winter he lost near as many calves as he saved, and the cold and the worry etched marks yet deeper in a face already changed forever by the forced sale of his home. But on the ridge where Tom was now, his father had smiled at what he saw about him, and known for the first time that his family could survive in this place, and might even prosper. Tom had told Annie about this while they rode across the plateau. During the morning, and even when they stopped to eat, there'd been too much going on for them to speak. But now both cattle and riders had the hang of things, and there was time. He'd ridden up alongside her, and she'd asked him the names of the flowers. He'd shown her blue flax, and cinquefoil, and balsam root, and the ones they called rooster heads. And Annie had listened in that serious way of hers, storing it all away as if one day she might be tested. It had been one of the warmest springs Tom could remember. The grass was lush and made a wet slicking sound against the legs of their horses. Tom had pointed out the ridge ahead and told her how he'd ridden with his father to its crest that long ago day to see if they were on the right line for the high pastures. Today Tom was riding one of his young mares, a pretty strawberry roan. Annie rode Rimrock. All day he'd thought how good she looked on him. She and Grace were wearing the hats and boots he'd helped them buy yesterday after Annie said she was coming. At the store, they'd laughed side by side at the sight of themselves in the glass. Annie had asked did they get to wear guns, too, and he said that depended on who she was going to shoot. She said the only candidate was her boss back in New York, so maybe a tomahawk missile might be better. Their crossing of the plateau was leisurely. But as the cattle reached the foot of the ridge, they seemed to sense that from here on it was one long climb, and they quickened the pace and called to each other as if to summon some collective effort. Tom had asked Annie to ride ahead with him, but she'd smiled and said she'd better drop back to see if Diane needed help. So he'd come up here alone. Now the herd was almost up to him. He turned his horse and rode over the crest of the ridge. A small crowd of mule deer vaulted away in front of him. At a safe distance, they stopped to look back. The does were heavy-bellied with their fawns and assessed him with their great tilted ears before the buck moved them off again. Beyond their bobbing heads, Tom could see the first of the narrow, pine-fringed passes that led to the high pastures, and leaning massively above them, the snow-patched peaks of the divide. He'd wanted to be beside Annie and see her face when this view was revealed to her, and he'd felt a loss when she declined and went back to Diane. Maybe she sensed in his offer an intimacy he hadn't meant, or rather one he yearned for but hadn't meant to convey. By the time they reached it, the pass was already in the shadow of the mountains, and as they moved slowly up between the darkening banks of trees, They looked back and saw the shadow spread east like a stain behind them until only the distant plains retained the sun. Above the trees on either side, sheer gray walls of rock encompassed them, making echoes of the children's calls and the murmur of the cattle. Frank threw another bough on the fire, and its impact sent a volcano of sparks into the night sky. The wood was from a fallen tree they'd found, and so dry it seemed to thirst for the flames that beset it, tonguing high into the windless air. Through the dodging of the flames, Annie watched the glow on the children's faces and noticed how their eyes and teeth flashed when they laughed. They were telling riddles, and Grace had them all guessing feverishly at one of Robert's favorites. Grace had her new hat tipped rakishly forward, and her hair, cascading from it to her shoulders, trapped the firelight in a spectrum of reds and ambers and golds. Never, Annie thought, had her daughter looked more lovely. They'd finished eating, a simple meal cooked on the fire of beans, chops, and salty bacon with jacket potatoes baked in the embers. It had tasted wonderful. Now, while Frank sought of the fire, Tom went to get water from the stream across the meadow so they could make coffee. Diane was joining in the riddle game now. Everyone assumed Annie knew the answer, and though she'd forgotten it, she was happy to keep quiet, lean back against her saddle, and observe. They'd reached this place just before 9, when the last of the sun was fading from the far-off plains. The final pass had been steep, with the mountains tilting over their heads like cathedral walls. At last they'd followed the cattle through an ancient gateway of rock and seen the pasture open up before them. The grass was thick and dark in the evening light, and because spring, Annie supposed, came later here, there were fewer flowers yet among it. Above, only the highest peak remained, and its angle had rolled to give a glimpse of a western slope where a sliver of snow glowed golden pink in the long-gone sun. The pasture was encircled by forest, and on one side, where the ground was slightly raised, stood a small log cabin with a simple pen for the horses. The stream looped in and out of the trees along the other side, and it was here first that they'd all gone to let the horses drink beside the jostling cattle. Tom had warned them that it could freeze up here at night and that they should bring warm clothes, but the air had stayed balmy. "How you doing there, Annie?" Frank had stacked the fire and was settling himself beside her. She could see Tom materializing from the darkness, beyond where, now and then, the invisible cattle called. "Frank, apart from my aching butt, I'm doing just great." He laughed. It wasn't just her butt. Her calves ached, too, and the insides of her thighs were so sore she winced every time she moved. Grace had lately ridden less even than she had, but when Annie had asked her earlier if she was sore too, she said she was fine and no, the leg didn't hurt at all. Annie didn't believe a word of it, but left it at that. "Remember those Swiss folk last year, Tom?" Tom was pouring water into the coffee pot. He laughed and said, "Yeah, he did," then set the pot on the fire and sat back beside Diane to listen. Frank said he and Tom had been driving through the Pryor Mountains and found their road blocked by a herd of cattle. Behind them came these cowboys all dressed to the nines in fancy new gear. One of them had on a pair of hand-tooled chaps, must have set him back $1,000. Funny thing was, they weren't riding, they were all walking, leading their horses behind them, and they looked real miserable. Anyway, me and Tom wind down the window and ask is everything okay, and they don't understand a word we're saying. Annie watched Tom across the corner of the fire. He was watching his brother and smiling his easy smile. He seemed to sense her gaze, for his eyes moved from Frank to her, and in them there was no surprise, only a calm so knowing it faltered her heart. She held his look for as long as she dared, then smiled and turned again to Frank. "We don't understand a word they're saying either, so we just wave and let them go by. Then up the road, we find this old guy dozing behind the wheel of a brand-new Winnebago, top of the range. And he lifts his hat, and I know the guy. It's Lonnie Harper, has a big spread over that way, but never could run it to save his life.
Anyway, we say howdy and ask, is that his herd back there? And he says, yeah, it sure is, and the cowboys are from Switzerland, all over here on vacation. Said he'd set himself up as a dude ranch, and these folks were paying him thousands of bucks to come and do what he used to have to pay hands to do. We said, why are they walking? And he laughed and said that was the best part, because after one day they all got too saddle sore to ride, so there wasn't even no wear on the horses. Way to go, Diane said. Yep. These poor Swiss fellows get to sleep on the ground and cook their own beans on the fire, while he sleeps in the Winnie, watches TV, and eats like a king. When the water boiled, Tom made coffee. The twins were through with riddles, and Craig asked Frank to show Grace's match trick. Oh, no, Diane groaned. Here we go. Frank took two matches from the box he kept in his vest pocket and placed one on the upturned palm of his right hand. Then, with a serious face, he leaned over and rubbed the head of the other match in Grace's hair. She laughed, a little uncertainly. You do physics and all that stuff at school, Grace, I guess.
Uh-huh.
Well, then you'll know about static electricity and all. That's all this really is. I'm just kind of charging up here. Oh, yeah, Scott said sarcastically. Joe promptly shushed him. Holding the charged match between finger and thumb with his left hand, Frank now drew it slowly up the palm of his right hand so that its head approached the head of the first match. As soon as they touched, there was a loud snap, and the first match jumped clean off his hand. Grace shrieked in surprise, and everyone laughed. She made him do it again, and then had a go herself, and of course it didn't work. Frank shook his head theatrically, as if baffled why it didn't. The kids were loving it. Diane, who must have seen it 100 times, gave Annie a tired, indulgent smile. The two women were getting on well. Better than ever, Annie believed, though only yesterday she'd been aware of a coolness, no doubt caused by Annie changing her mind at the last minute about coming on the cattle drive. Riding together today, they'd talked easily about all sorts of things. But still, somewhere beneath Diane's friendliness, Annie sensed a wariness that was less than dislike, yet more than mistrust. More than anything, she noticed the way Diane watched her when she was around Tom. It was this that had led Annie, against all desire, to decline Tom's invitation this afternoon to ride with him to the top of the ridge. "What do you reckon, Tom?" Frank said. "Try some water?" "Reckon so, brother." A dutiful conspirator, he passed Frank the can he'd filled from the stream, and Frank told Grace to roll up her sleeves and immerse both arms up to the elbows. Grace was giggling so much she poured half of it down her shirt. "Kind of gets the charge going, you know?" 10 minutes later, none the wiser and much the wetter, Grace gave up. During that time, both Tom and Joe successfully made the match jump, and Annie had a go but couldn't make it move. The twins couldn't do it either. Diane confided to Annie that the first time Frank tried it on her, it got her sitting fully clothed in a cattle trough. Then Scott asked Tom to do his rope trick.
"It ain't a trick," Joe said.
"Is too."
"It ain't, is it, Tom?"
Tom smiled. "Well, it kind of depends what you mean by trick." He pulled something from the pocket of his jeans. It was a simple piece of gray cord about 2 feet long. He tied the ends together to make a loop. "Okay," he said, "this one's for Annie." He got up and came toward her.
"Not if it involves pain or death," Annie said.
"Ma'am, you won't feel a thing." He knelt down beside her and asked her to hold up the first finger of her right hand. She did, and he put the loop over it, then told her to watch carefully. Holding the other end of the loop taut with his left hand, he drew one side of the cord over the other with the middle finger of his right hand. Then he rolled the hand over so it was under the loop, then back over it again, and put the same finger tip to tip with Annie's. It seemed now that the loop circled their touching fingertips and that it could only be removed if the touch were broken. Tom paused, and she looked up at him. He smiled, and the nearness of his clear blue eyes almost overwhelmed her. "Look," he said softly. And she looked down again at their touching fingers, and gently he pulled the cord, and it slipped away and was free, still knotted, and without ever breaking their touch. He showed her a few more times, and then Annie tried, and Grace tried, and the twins tried, and none of them could do it.
Joe was the only one who could, though Annie could see from his grin that Frank also knew how. Whether Diane knew too, it was hard to tell, for all she did was sip her coffee and watch with a sort of half-amused detachment. When everyone was through trying, Tom stood up and wound the loop around his fingers to make a neat coil of it. He handed it to Annie. "Is this a gift?" she said as she took it. "Nope," he said, "just till you get the hang of it." She woke, and for a moment had no idea what she was looking at. Then she remembered where she was and realized she was staring at the moon. It seemed close enough for her to reach out and place her fingers in its craters. She turned her head and saw Grace's sleeping face beside her. Frank had offered them the cabin, which normally they only used if it was raining. Annie was tempted, but Grace had insisted they sleep outside with the others. Annie could see them lying in their sleeping bags beside the dimming glow of the fire. She felt thirsty, and so alert it was hopeless to try again for sleep. She sat up and looked around. She couldn't see the water can, and would be sure to wake the others in the search. Across the meadow, the black shapes of the cattle cast shadows yet blacker on the pale moonlit grass. She slipped her legs quietly from the sleeping bag and felt again the havoc done to her muscles by the riding. They'd slept in their clothes, only taking off their boots and socks. Annie was wearing jeans and a white T-shirt. She stood up and set off barefoot toward the stream. The dew-drenched grass felt cool and thrilling on her feet, though she took care where she placed them for fear of stepping in something less romantic. Somewhere high among the trees, an owl was calling, and she wondered if it was this or the moon or plain habit that had woken her. The cattle lifted their heads to look as she passed among them, and she whispered a greeting, then felt foolish for doing so. The grass on the near bank of the stream was churned by the cattle's hooves. The water moved slow and silent, its glass surface reflecting only the black of the forest beyond. Annie walked upstream and found a place where the flow divided smoothly around an island tree. With two long steps, she reached the far side and walked downstream again to a tapered overhang of bank where she could kneel to drink. Viewed from here, the water now reflected only sky. And so perfect was the moon that Annie hesitated to disturb it. The shock of the water, when at last she did, made her gasp. It was colder than ice, as if it flowed from the ancient glacial heart of the mountain. Annie cupped it in ghost-pale hands and bathed her face. Then she cupped some more and drank. She saw him first in the water, when he loomed across the reflected moon that had so transfixed her gaze she'd lost all sense of time. It didn't startle her. Even before she looked up, she knew it was him. "Are you okay?" he said. The other bank where he stood was higher, and she had to squint up at him against the moon. She could read the concern on his face. She smiled. "I'm fine. I woke up and saw you weren't there. I was just thirsty." "The bacon, I suppose. Does the water taste as good as that glass of rain the other night?" "Almost. Try it." He looked down at the water and saw it would be easier to reach from where she was. "Mind if I come over? I'm disturbing you." Annie almost laughed. "Oh, no, you're not. Be my guest." He walked to the island tree and crossed, and Annie watched and knew that more was being crossed than water. He smiled as he came close, and when he reached her, he knelt beside her, and without a word cupped his hand to the water and drank. Some slipped between his fingers, quickening the moonlight in silver trickles. It seemed to Annie, and would always seem, that in what followed there was no element of choice. Some things simply were and could not be rendered otherwise.
She trembled now at its doing, and would tremble later at the thought of it, though never once with regret. He finished drinking and turned to her, and as he was about to brush the water from his face, she reached out and did it for him. She felt the cold of the water on the back of her fingers, and might have taken it as rejection and removed her hand had she not then felt through it the confirming warmth of his flesh. And with this touch, the world went still. His eyes had only the unifying pale of the moon. Clarified of color, they seemed to have some limitless depth, into which she now traveled with wonder, but quite without misgiving. He gently raised his hand to the hand she yet held to his cheek, and he took it and turned it and pressed her palm to his lips as if sealing some long-awaited welcome. Annie watched him and took a long quiver of breath. Then she reached out with her other hand and ran it across the side of his face, from his harsh, unshaven cheek to the softness of his hair. She felt his hand brush the underside of her arm and stroke her face as she had stroked his. At his touch she closed her eyes and blindly let his fingers trace a delicate path from her temples to the corners of her mouth. When his fingers reached her lips, she parted them and let him tenderly explore their rim. She dared not open her eyes, for fear she might see in his some reticence or doubt or even pity. But when she looked, she found only calm and certainty, and a need as legible as her own. He put his hands to her elbows and smoothed them up inside the sleeves of her t-shirt to hold her upper arms. Annie felt her skin contract. She had both her hands in his hair now, and she gently drew his head toward her and felt an equal pressure on her arms. In the instant before their mouths touched, Annie had a sudden urge to say she was sorry, that he should please forgive her. This wasn't what she'd meant to do. He must have seen the thought take shape in her eyes, for before she could utter it, he shushed her softly, with but the smallest moving of his lips. When they kissed, it seemed to Annie she was coming home, that somehow she had always known the taste and the feel of him. And though she almost quaked at the touch of his body against her, she could not tell at what precise point her own skin ended and his began. How long they kissed, Tom could only guess from his own changed shadow on her face when they stopped and moved apart a little to look at each other. She gave him a sad smile, then looked up at the moon in its new place and trapped pieces of it in her eyes. He could still taste the sweet wetness of her glistening mouth and feel the warmth of her breath on his face. He ran his hands down her bare arms and felt her shiver. "Are you cold?"
"No.
I've never known a June night so warm up here." She looked down, then took one of his hands in both of hers and cradled it palm upward in her lap, tracing the calluses with her fingers.
"Your skin's so hard."
"Uh-huh. It's a sorry hand for sure."
"No, it's not. Can you feel me touching it?"
"Oh, yes." She didn't look up. Through the dark arch made by her falling hair, he saw a tear run on her cheek. "Annie." She shook her head and still didn't look at him. He took hold of her hands. "Annie, it's okay. Really, it's okay."
"I know it is. It's just that... it's so okay. I don't know how to handle it."
"We're just two people, that's all." She nodded.
"Who met too late."
She looked at him at last and smiled and wiped her eyes. Tom smiled back but didn't answer. If what she said was true, he didn't want to endorse it. Instead, he told her what his brother had said on a night much the same, yet under a thinner moon so many years ago. How Frank had wished that now could last forever. And how their father had said forever was but a trail of nows, and the best a man could do was live each one fully in its turn. Her eyes never left him while he spoke, and when he'd finished, she stayed silent, so that suddenly he worried she might have taken his words amiss and seen in them some self-serving incitement. Behind them, in the pines, the owl began to call again, and was answered now, far across the meadow, by another. Annie leaned forward and found his mouth again, and he felt in her an urgency that wasn't there before. He tasted the salt of her tears and the corner of her lips, that place he'd yearned so long to touch and never dreamed he'd kiss. And as he held her and moved his hands on her and felt the press of her breasts against him, he thought not that this was wrong, but only concerned that she might come to feel it so. But if this were wrong, then what in the whole of life was right? At last she broke away and leaned back from him, breathing hard, as if daunted by her own hunger and where it would surely lead.
"I'd better go back," she said.
"You'd better." She kissed him gently once more, then laid her head on his shoulder so that he couldn't see her face. He brushed his lips on her neck and breathed the warm smell of her as if to store it, perhaps forever.
"Thank you," she whispered.
"What for?"
"For what you've done for all of us."
"I've done nothing."
"Oh, Tom, you know what you've done."
She disengaged herself and stood in front of him, with her hands resting lightly on his shoulders. She smiled down at him and stroked his hair, and he took her hand and kissed it. Then she left him and walked to the island tree and crossed the stream. Once only did she turn to look at him, though with the moon behind her, what look it was he could but guess. He watched her white shirt go back across the meadow, its shadow trailing footprints in the gray of the dew, while the cattle glided about her, black and silent as ships.
This ends Disc 8.